Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Okay, if my voice diminishes and you can't, just give me a shout, please. There's only two of us in this session this afternoon, and so rather than get a separate person to chair it, Scott's going to give me the five-minute warning, and I'm going to give him the five-minute warning. My name's Heather Loy, as you can see on the screen. I teach psychology at the King's University College in Edmonton, Alberta. And this talk that I want to give this afternoon is a bit of a new area for me. And so what you're getting are claims and questions that are coming from really a host of sources. And I'm putting them out before you as ideas to consider. And so I'll welcome and appreciate your commentary and feedback. At the end of these slides that will be posted on the website, I do have a number of references of sources that I've used. There are lots more out there, but it's a selected list that if you're interested in these questions, you're welcome to pursue them further. All right. So, in the beginning, God created. God created everything, not just human beings, but the whole creation, and God saw that it was good. That we sang this morning in the worship service, "All thy work shall praise thy name in earth and sky and sea." So I want to start this talk by just reminding you of the bigness of creation. It isn't just about us. It's about all creation. And God loves and sustains all creation. God is trying to redeem all creation. And we have a role to play in that process. But God adores all the rest of it, just as much as God adores us. Thomas Berry, who's was a Catholic priest, a cultural historian, and an eco-theologian, reminds us that the revelation found in the natural world and in the wider universe around us is the primary divine revelation. Special revelation was only necessary because of human fallenness. And we can ask questions about whether God foreknew that or intended that or anything, but the point is that the creation was made by God. The creation tells us about who God is, and we were intended to know God through the revelation of that creation. We were created from this creation, in this creation, and for this creation. And that knowledge and that longing lies deeply within us, even as we have drifted farther and farther away from that intimate connection. So let me start with a story. When I was 15 years old, I spent 2 months one summer in Tweedsmuir Provincial Park in British Columbia on a crew with two dozen other 15-year-old girls, building trails, maintaining campgrounds, backpacking, learning about the land and the history of the local Aboriginal people. I sweated, I swatted mosquitoes, sometimes I thought I would die. I labored, I laughed, I learned the exquisite rewards of work that was somehow real, that mattered in a land that delighted and nourished me. Drinking and washing in breathtakingly cold mountain streams, savoring the sweet burst of flavor from the wild strawberries, dizzily gazing at a night sky pulsing with stars and galaxies and asteroids, something that I never had the opportunity to see growing up in the city of Victoria, hearing the call and rustle of the many non-human others for whom this place was home. All of these were transformative experiences for me. And returning to the city at the end of those 2 months was one of the hardest transitions I have ever made in my life. The ugliness of the smells, the noise, the buildings, the litter, and the isolation among strangers that I experienced returning to the city made me want to turn right around and hide myself in the forest and live off the land. And you need to understand that before I headed out to Tweedsmuir, I was conjuring up as many possible ways as I could to become suddenly too ill to go, because I was terrified of going into the wild for that period of time. So this is truly a transformation for me. The philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau said, "Everything is good in leaving the hands of the Creator. Everything degenerates in the hands of humankind." And that summer's end, for the first time of many, I grieved at the destructive way we live in this creation, and I longed to find ways to live lightly and graciously in harmony with the world that nourishes and sustains us. The transformation that I experienced that summer is not unusual. Social ecologist Stephen Kellert suggests that we all bear within us a characteristic that he and E.O. Wilson call biophilia, which is a fundamental genetically based need and propensity to affiliate with life and the lifelike process. We need to live in contact with the rest of the natural world. It is actually unhealthy for us, let alone the rest of creation, to barricade ourselves in climate-controlled, artificially lit buildings set in seas of concrete and pavement, moving between them in air-conditioned cars, eating food so tidied, packaged, and processed that it bears little resemblance to its sources, and spending the majority of our time interacting with screens. I recognize the irony. At an ever-accelerating pace over especially the last 400 years, the people of the Western world, primarily Europe and North America, have industrialized and urbanized. In 1990, less than 40% of the world's population lived in cities. By 2010, more than half. And according to the World Health Organization, this percentage is going up by about 7% every decade. Technology dominates our lives, not the natural world. Increasingly, we spend our lives in built environments, using almost exclusively our senses of sight and, to a somewhat lesser extent, hearing, staring with narrowed and foreshortened vision at screens. This talk is actually a case in point. As I was preparing for it, I seriously considered not doing the talk at all, but simply telling you at this point, get out of this room. Go out to that atrium, go outside, spend the next half hour just staring at a square meter of something natural, something real, and just see what happens. And I actually honestly think that you'd probably get more out of this half hour if you did that than if you stay here and listen to me. But I'm going to stay here and keep talking, so it's up to you. In 2004, U.S. children were observed to be spending less than 30 minutes outside every day and 7 hours in front of screens outside of school per day. Now, some of you may be going, oh, my kids don't do that. And there's lots of people who try to buck that trend. But this is on average, and that was in 2004. This difference is increasing. Those numbers are the difference between outside and screen time is going up. I have a cousin that I met just before this conference here in Ontario, and she was I could only meet with her briefly because she was dragging her two sons out of the house and forcing them to spend some time on a playground because she said, you know, if I didn't force them to do it, they would spend the entire summer like this in front of their screens, and that would be their preference. So, why does any of this matter? I'm saying all this as if it's a problem, but I haven't actually established that it is. I think it matters because the environmental problems that we face, and they are real and serious, are primarily caused by human activity. The environmental issues, the degradation that we're encountering, is not just happening all by itself. It's happening because of us. And it's happening through our industrialization, urbanization, use of technology, and so on. These activities occur to the destructive extent that they do, I submit, because we ourselves are alienated or disconnected from that natural world. So this alienation is not only a key reason for our ability to degrade the very planet that is our home and that nourishes and sustains us, but also is bad for our own psychological and spiritual well-being. Okay. So we enjoy unprecedented health, life expectancy, leisure, comfort, safety, and security, especially in the Western world, historically speaking. We can't deny that. But we're not happier for it. And people who do cross-cultural research are consistently revealing that the correlation between human happiness and life conditions is very weak, except in the most dire of circumstances. So having everything, you know, all the security, all the safety, all the health, all the stuff you could ever want, you know, all the fun you could ever want, doesn't actually make you happier. And the research is bearing that out. What is even more significant is that we're not happy and we're getting more unhappy. So if you do surveys of people who aren't necessarily going to their doctors for pills for anxiety or depression and so on, aren't being diagnosed with major depressive disorders and anxiety disorders and so on, but you ask them how they're feeling, so these subclinical rates of anxiety and depression are going up. A startling number of people are saying, I feel anxious a lot of the time, or I really struggle with depression. And those rates are increasing rapidly. We're seeing astonishing increases in the rates of attention deficit disorders and things like autism. In some countries, that rate has been gone up by 45% over two decades. We're seeing increases in sleep disorders, especially disorders like insomnia, where people are just really struggling with getting enough sleep. Interestingly, we're seeing a real increase in the rate of myopia, nearsightedness. People are just not able to see at a distance anymore. And ophthalmologists are suggesting that one of the reasons for that is that we don't look in the distance anymore. We spend most of our time staring at screens. In even a room as large as this, that's not very far away. We're seeing increases in rates of substance abuse, and perhaps most striking of all, we are seeing a lot of off-label drug use. So we see up to half of university undergraduates, we see a lot of workers, especially in the corporate world, consuming stimulants, consuming drugs like methylphenidate, which is normally used for things like attention deficit, and drugs like modafinil, which are used as a treatment for people with sleep disorders in order to enhance wakefulness. These drugs are intended to keep people alert, to give them enhanced attention, to help them concentrate, to help them stay awake. Now, sorry, I'm thinking about time, so I'm skipping a little bit here. This kind of increase in various forms of psychological distress or difficulties functioning in everyday life or feeling the need for supports in order to function in everyday life has probably lots of causes. It's very difficult to tease out methodologically why these things are happening. Why are diagnoses going up? Is that because people are more aware? Is it because we've changed our criteria? Because we have new treatments available? And so on. So there's probably a host of reasons for this. We do know that the best predictors of many of these forms of psychological distress are low social connectedness and high environmental threat. Now, both of these are very closely related to Western values and the Western way of life. Highly individualized, competitive, and mobile, so you don't have a lot of deep, intense, supportive social support networks and sustaining communities over long periods of time. Along with the stresses of job insecurity, economic challenges, and natural and clearly human-caused environmental disasters from hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, wildfires, droughts, to oil spills, depleted soils, and so on. So when we talk about high environmental threat, we're talking about everything from whether or not you think you're going to get fired next week to the possibility that the livelihood of your entire village is now shot because the fishery just collapsed. Now, the question is alienation from the natural world a causal factor in the increase in these disorders and this distress? And is it possible that reconnection with the natural world might mitigate some of these problems, might help us to heal? Those, again, are questions, they're empirical questions, and we need to do more research. But a lot of work is being done already on it. And the very fact that we can do research that asks the question, is connection with the natural world of benefit to us, is a testament to the fact that we are disconnected from the natural world. If you go to a traditionally living indigenous culture, you can't even ask the question because none of them are disconnected from their local environment. But we in the West are able to do these studies very easily because it's really easy to find people who have very minimal connection with the natural world, or at best it's sporadic or part of their, you know, summertime vacation once a year. Now, what follows is a very brief and highly selected quick overview of some of this research and some of the results of it. But if you want to dig more deeply, you can find an avalanche of studies, and they all point in the same direction. So this research was already done in the 1980s. Simply being able to see trees from your hospital window reduces the length of the stay, the number and variety of pain medications that you need, the number of complications, and also improves your mood. And this has been demonstrated in several studies, so it's been well replicated in studies that control for things like what you were in there for and your age and your general health going in and all that sort of thing. If you can control for those factors and the key variable is just what you're seeing out the window, being able to see trees compared to seeing a brick wall makes a difference. People like to exercise. It's good for you. Physical exercise is one of the best things you can do for yourself, not only physically, but psychologically. It turns out that physical exercise in a natural setting is even better for you than physical exercise in an unnatural setting. So get out of your gym clubs and your fitness centers and get outside and run on the trails. Being in a natural setting is also even better than running outside in a city environment, particularly in relation to the psychological impact of the exercise. This study was done in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and they had people randomly assigned to spend time walking either in a botanical garden or in the downtown area. They did pre-tests and post-tests of things like mood and also attentional abilities, and they found that the people who were in the botanical gardens showed significant improvements in mood and attentional abilities. The people who walked down the city streets showed either no change or a decrease in those abilities. We know that if you introduce into nursing homes gardens that people can not only be in, but ideally even participate in, or people who you give them plants even indoors to care for, that this is well correlated with alertness, with participation in the life of the nursing home community, with mood and feelings of well-being. And it's a little bit harder to track this, but it seems like it might be, and we need more studies on this, also related to improvements in physical well-being and possibly even longevity. Animal-assisted therapy, connecting with another non-human but living creature, shows tremendous benefits and often is of great help for people who are not responsive to normal forms of therapy, like talk therapy or even drug therapy, people who are resistant to that kind of thing. And it's used in lots of situations to reduce the need for pain medication and distress in hospital settings, and also in therapeutic settings for children who suffer from autism or attention deficit disorders, or who are being antisocial in their behavior. There's a big movement now to alter the nature of our schoolyards. This is a standard urban schoolyard. There's lots of pavement. There's a few play things there. And that's pretty common for schoolyards. There might be an odd tree here and there, but in fact, a lot of North American schoolyards are so constructed to be open like this because of fears that if you have, you know, too many, if you don't have clear sight lines for the playground supervisors, that kids can get up to nasty things out in the corners behind. We're worried about bullying and so on. Turns out, this kind of schoolyard is not very conducive to good behavior. The naturalization of schoolyards, whether you're growing, whether you're getting the school children to grow food, for example, have an actual garden, or whether it's just simply a more natural kind of area with a variety of natural substances present, you know, you can take out the playground equipment and you still get the effects. What researchers are finding is that bullying goes down. Aggressive behavior goes down. The teachers love these kinds of playgrounds because they have fewer disciplinary problems in the classroom. Creativity is going up. Imaginative play is going up. A movement even further to naturalizing schoolyards is what is called forest schools. These schools started in Scandinavia. They've been picked up by several other European countries, also in the UK. The North America has been quite resistant to them, but there are a few around. And basically, you know, whether these are preschool children or elementary school children, they spend, no matter what the weather, and they do this in Norway, so like right through the winter in Norway, these children are outside the majority of the hours of the day. We've got 3-year-olds who learn how to use knives safely. We've got kids climbing trees. And so on. And yes, sometimes they fall, and sometimes they skin a knee, sometimes they break a bone. These are not fatal. But actually, the rate of injury is lower than it is in a standardized schoolyard. And not only that, but the outcomes for the children are phenomenal in terms of all the things that teachers really want to have happen in school. People have known for a long time, we've seen this if you look into ancient cultures already, the importance of natural settings for healing and for therapy. Okay. All right. So, I am really short on time here. This always happens to me. Okay, what is it about the natural world that might be having these effects? What's going on? We don't really know the answer to that. It's clear that the effects are not merely due to being outside as opposed to inside. You can be outside in a very non-natural setting. It's not just due to the increase in physical activity, which is, increasing physical activity is by itself a good thing to do. There's something else going on. Some researchers suggest that if you are out in an area with a lot of trees, that you may be exposed to these volatile wood oils that are known as phytoncides. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And there's been some research in Japan on this because the Japanese have a practice that they refer to as, what's it called again? I have the name written down here somewhere. Shinrin yoku, or forest bathing, as they refer to it. And it's thought that these oils are actually immune system boosters. And there's been some research to suggest that natural killer cell activity and anti-cancer products are boosted when you're exposed to these substances. In soil, there's a bacteria called Mycobacterium vaccae. Again, I read these words. I don't hear people say them. And there's some thought that this particular bacterium also has beneficial effects on health. And so when you're out playing in the dirt, you're actually exposing yourself to this bacterium. Some researchers are interested in this because they figure, well, people don't have to go outside. We're just going to put these in pills and then, you know, we can stay inside and we can take them and get better. There seems to be more going on than that. But we need to explore this. These are still open empirical questions. So, some of you might be wondering what on earth I mean by nature. I have a definition here by Richard Louv. Human beings exist in nature anywhere that they experience meaningful kinship with other species. So, you know, if you're petting your cat in your house, you're having a connection with the natural world. But, you know, nature itself is something that's difficult to define. We kind of know what we mean, but if you're going to do research on it, you've got to be a little bit more precise about the definition. One of the things that may be important for the benefits of the natural world, though, is the fact that nature is not always comfortable and it's not always safe. And the very fact that that's true, that there's danger here, that you need to be alert, it draws upon psychological capacities within us that don't get used in our safe, controlled urban environments. And it is drawing on those capacities. It is that risk, it is that danger that's critical for the utilization of all of your senses and for the expansion of your capacities and perceptions. Again, right now, that's still kind of speculation. And we need to do some research to figure that out. So, evolutionary biology suggests that we were created within this creation, that we have it, that we belong to it, and that the characteristics that we have are a reflection of the creatures we interacted with, the landscapes that we were part of. Christian theology also reminds us that, as I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, that God is revealed in creation. God relates to us through the creation. To pull ourselves away from that creation is to pull ourselves away from the possibility of getting to know God in subtle and important ways. Christ was there in the beginning. And everything in heaven and earth is founded in Christ. The incarnation of Jesus as a human being came a lot later than the incarnation of God in the creation. And I think that we forget that. We focus on the human side of things. And so what has happened to us is that we see nature as an inert, non-enchanted, unholy, and even dangerous place. We tend to believe that humans are the only creatures that God cares about, and all else is literally just food for our own sustenance and enjoyment. So, what I submit to you is that the problem we have here is that modern science and modern Christianity are both weirdly disconnected from the natural world. Yes, scientists love to study the natural world, but we tend to study it as if it's this inert thing out there. It's a mechanism, it's an object. We don't study it as if, you know, it has value of it in itself and that we are in relationship to it. So I think that there's some repentance and some turning that needs to happen. Christians tend to spiritualize our faith so that the natural world is a veil of tears that we are going to leave at some point. I commend to you, because I'm out of time, some of the writing of Wendell Berry, and I have in the PowerPoints that will be posted some quotes from him that illustrate those points. The world doesn't want to be saved, it wants to be loved. And we're called to love it and to be in relationship with it. And that will not only further our own well-being, but that of the rest of creation. I'm sorry I went over time, my apologies. I think, to be fair to Scott, we should probably move directly on to his talk, but I'm willing to stay and answer questions or hear your comments afterwards. So thank you very much.